Okay, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. So I'm going to ask you to please give a warm Valley Group welcome to our friend Dan from Visalia.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Dan, and I am an alcoholic. You know, I've been involved with this group for 10 years, ever since it began. And Bill asked me the other day, he said, have I ever asked you to share? And I said, no. So I think it's a perfect time to share on our 10th anniversary here. So here we go. You know, they say I need to share my experience, strength, and hope. My experience is I am a son of an alcoholic who was a son of an alcoholic. So this runs in my family, and I truly believe there is a genetic connection for this disease. My dad was a drunk. I was by myself most of the time because he had a business. We lived out in the country. There was no other kids around me, so I became very introverted. You know, and as the story goes, I mean, I was a shy young kid that didn't like to socialize much. Because of that, I became my own best friend. I was very introverted. I played, you know, with different things and included only myself. But one thing I did do, I was, again, a very fearful kid, and I used to watch out the back window every night until my dad got home. I don't think anybody knew that, but I was so afraid that he was out drinking that I would stay up at night, look out the back window until I could see him drive in. You know, and over time I built a big resentment about that, and I said, I'd never be like that SOB. I will never be like him. And I ended up just like him, because this is a disease that I believe, again, is genetic. And we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And, you know, my story is kind of divided up into three chapters here. One chapter is 10 years of continuous sobriety early in my 1994, when I came in, 10 years of sobriety. Then I had what I call the 7 years in the wilderness. And that's kind of when I came in and out a lot of this in this program. I could never reset that base. I thought, you know, I had 10 years sobriety. All I have to do is just hop back on the horse and get riding again, you know. But that didn't work for me. And I had to get so desperate that 3 years ago in June, I went back out again. And there's some funny stories involved in all of this. We in the first 10 years, the way I went out then was, you know, I did AA backwards. When I got in here, I had a childlike faith that God would do for me what I could not do for myself. And the way I got that originally was, I remember my first sponsor would tell me, he said, I called him and I said, man, my head is just going crazy. I can't sleep at night. I have to keep the TV on, listen to radio, something to calm my head down. I said, I'm at the end of my rope. And my sponsor told me something. He said, God's got you right where he wants you. Let go. And I was desperate enough at that time to let go. And that's when the spiritual awakening I had gave me 10 years of sobriety. Well, and as that went on, you know, I was doing 3 meetings a week to 4 meetings a week. I would meet with my sponsor. I would do all the necessary things. I was everything in the alphabet. So we were just talking about GSR, CSR. I was all those things. I was secretaries. At this meeting alone, I've done every job, only fired from one, and that was being the secretary of this because I didn't add right. But anyway, After about 7 or 8 years, you know, I stopped going to as many meetings as I did. My home group was on Friday night, and my son, he's a starter in football. Football's on Friday. I can't miss my son's game. So that, but I lost my home group as well. And I'd pick one up at the Lano Club, or I'd do this or that, but gradually the meetings went away. Well, guess what? The sobriety went away too. And it was my wife's 40th birthday, I think, and we went over to Justin Winery because it was a bed and breakfast place that she really wanted to stay at. And so I bought her dinner there, and we were sitting in the room they had there, and there was a big center table set up, and the owner was there, and there was a lot of people that were all around, and the owner stood up and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, you are very lucky tonight. Tonight, I am going to serve some special wines." He said, "Tonight, I'm going to serve a champagne that was served at the White House 4 weeks ago." Boy, I lit up. And I said, "Self, am I ever going to get a chance again to drink champagne served at the White House?" And I looked at my wife and I said, "Honey, I don't think a sip would hurt me." She already thought I graduated anyway, you know. And so long story short, I had that glass of wine, and I had some other ones that he opened up as well. Got a little buzz on, but you know what? I didn't head right back out, and I thought, man, everyone's going to be tipping their hat at me, right? Because I can drink like a gentleman. Well, what happened is that particular drink didn't send me out that night, but what it did, it lit the fuse. And we got back at home, and 2 days from that, I heard on ABC News that if you drink red wine, it will help you from having a heart attack. Well, you know, heart attack runs in my family, so I'm sure a glass of red wine won't hurt me. Well, we all know how this ended up. I was back drinking the straight vodka out of the bottle the way I was when I first started this thing. And I share that story because we do deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And it will tell you you've graduated. It will tell you one glass of wine ain't going to hurt. But I'm here to tell you it does. And even if you don't get drunk that night, you're off and running on a merry-go-round that will only stop if someone stops me. Because I can't do it on my own will. I then went on to the what I call the 7 years in the wilderness, and what that is was I'd get 2 years sobriety, 3 years sobriety. I actually called it at the time sobriety because that's all it was. It wasn't true sobriety. I just wasn't drinking for those times because I cut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And once I lost my conscious contact with God, I had no way of stopping the alcoholism from having me run amok. And I, like I said, I'd white knuckle it, but I was never happy, joyous, and free. And I never thought I had to come in as a newcomer again. I just thought, well, you had 10 years, you know how to do this. Just hop on the horse and ride again, you know. Kind of review the steps with your new sponsor and everything will be cool. Well, that's not the way it works. Because you know what happened? My pride had to be smashed. Just like we do when we say the third step lead in. And I had to get desperate enough for me to smash that pride. And I had to consider going to what I considered at the time the last house on the block. You know, and I had many great sponsors along the way, but it wasn't them, it was me. And I went, you know, I kept this phone number in my phone for years, and every phone I switched, I happened to just switch this number over. His name was Teddy Blackman. And I gave Teddy a call, and I met up with him over at the Thursday night meeting, and I said, "Teddy, I don't know what to do. I can't find an answer to this." He said, well, are you willing to do whatever it takes? I said, yes. I painted myself into the corner of the last house of the block. I have nowhere else to turn. So we started on a journey that was completely different, ended up completely different than any journey in AA I have ever had. Because you see, I did the steps many number of times. But working one-on-one with Teddy and working in this book, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and going through each page, and even though I've read it I don't know how many times, there were things in there I never realized. It says in here that this book is designed for you to find a higher power. I never knew that. In fact, I never read the chapter on the agnostics because I was a Christian. What do I need to read the chapter on the agnostics for? Guess what? That's where the magic happens. So we went through it page by page, and we went through it step by step. And what I did this time was experience the steps. Because you see, this is a divine book, in my opinion. And this is our divine escape. And God made it easy for us. He had these men think up these things called steps. And they happen one at a time. And it, you know, these are the steps as I went through them. We have the first step. And by the way, these are steps of action, I found out. You actually have to do something. These steps of action, step one, it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. But I also had to admit that no human power, including my own power, can keep me sober. And my life had become unmanageable. And what I found out, step one is three different sections. And this is, did the chicken or the egg come first here? But it's, we have a physical craving and we have a mental obsession. Now, I don't know what way it comes, but whatever happens, once I take that first drink, I keep going. But I believe that mental obsession comes prior to me taking that drink. You know, and one of the times I went out, again, I was, that's in my 7 years in the wilderness, when I really wasn't doing the program, even though I thought I was. I was driving home, bad, bad day at work. And I drove by this liquor store, turned in, walked to the beer, where the beer wasn't dry, and got two tall boys. Why in the hell would I do that? I think I had 4 or 5 years of sobriety, maybe 3 years of sobriety, I can't remember. But I had years of sobriety. But that's our mental obsession. That's how it works. Because we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it is always working. It wants you dead, but it will settle for drunk. And that's what happened to me. I turned in, bought a couple beers, went home. Nothing really happened. But once again, the fuse was lit. And it was just a short matter of time, when I was drinking just as much as I was when I first came into this program. And in fact, it had gotten a little worse. But what's happening now is it's not working for me. Son of a gun, what am I going to do? I've lost my best friend. I can't stay sober. All I have is sobriety, which is no peace, white knuckling it, and even booze doesn't work anymore. And again, there I am at the last house on the block again. Where do you turn? Well, I had to turn to my higher power. This is, in step one where it says no human power could keep us from drinking, is when I realized how unmanageable my life really was. And that's all of step one. I had to find the power in step one to drive me into step two. And again, here, these are action steps. I'm just going to go through the steps here real quick. It says, willing to consider so that a power greater than myself could restore me to sobriety. I had to be willing. I had to, in step three, make a decision. Again, action. I had to make a decision to turn my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I made an inventory in step four. Again, this all takes work, guys. And what I found as I was going through each one of these steps and doing these actions is that my God gave me the power I needed to take that next step. And that's why we do them in order. We don't jump from 1 to 9 to 12, although I tried that a couple times. But we don't do that because in experiencing this step, we build the power in our God that we lose. Because we are powerless unless we have that spiritual experience. It says in the doctor's opinion that we have to have a psychic change. And the only way I have a psychic change, and it says in there, the only way you can have a psychic change is through a spiritual experience. And through taking action. Step five, I had to admit to God. Again, another action. And six, I had to be ready. I had to be ready through prayer and meditation. Step seven, I had to make a list. Step seven, not step eight. Step seven, humbly ask Him. So I had to do two things. I had to be humble, which is hard for an alcoholic to do, and I had to ask. Another action. Make a list. Again, I had to do something. I had to make a list. Make amends. Another thing, I had an action. And then 10 is take an inventory again on a daily basis. So what I found with doing these steps is that each one has an action involved. And with that action, with my higher power, I gain the power needed to face the next step. I did these steps with Teddy, and then it came to step 12. Step 12, it says in if you, anyone got a chip, if you look on the back of the chip that you got today, it has unity, service, and recovery. Unity is the body here. We're the unity. We're the group. And I suggest all you get a home group, because that's very important as well, because there you get the same people, the same stories, and you are able to find a home with your family, and that's very important. Another thing that I need that I found I needed is a book study. And getting back to the back of your chip, it's unity, service, and recovery. First is unity, which is the body. Second is service, which is the spirit. And third is recovery, and that's doing the 12 steps in this book, in the textbook that God gave us. You know, I always thought service was emptying ashtrays, making the coffee, putting the chairs out. I told Bill at one time, I said, I did more service in AA than service master. But guess what? It didn't keep me sober. It would keep me sober in sobriety a little bit, but because it just kept me in action. But what really is keeping me sober is working with others. And that's the full circle of this AA stuff that we do. Because without working with others, it's all about me. And to stay sober, I have to be outside of me. Because I remember my wife telling me, "You are the most selfie-centered SOB that I've ever met." And guess what? She was right. Because when we're in our disease, it's all about us. But what happens when you work with others is that you get out of yourself. And what that does is give me freedom. So what I've experienced this time around is freedom. And a high that I could never get drinking or using. AA to me is a way of life now. And working with others is what God has put us all on this planet for. I find that, why are we here on earth? You know, we always ask that question. Well, I know why I'm here on earth. I'm here on earth to worship my higher power and to help my fellow man. And when I do that, guess what? All the promises come true. You know, God has been so good to me. I'm so grateful. I can't even tell you. I've been able to completely turn my life around, not only spiritually, but financially, and all the other things that the promises say that will happen. I can do things that I could never face before. I can face fears like coming up in front of you and speak, and my job's a salesman now. Here's this kid that was so afraid and so alone, I couldn't do anything without taking a drink, to a salesman. Only God can do that. Not only a salesman, I was the most successful salesman in our company last year. That's not me, that's God. And that's what God can do for you. He can take your life if you're willing to do the work and to get this spiritual awakening and work with the sponsor and do the steps. You too can be free. I remember my first sponsor told me, he says, you know, we all have this God hole right here. And we take all these different substances and beer and whiskey and everything to try to fill this God hole that we have. But guess what? It's not in the shape of a Budweiser. It's in the shape of our higher power. And only by plugging that in am I complete. But you see, for years and years, that black spot here was trying to be filled with a Budweiser. And I know, I apologize, I'm kind of jumping all around here, but when I was in construction, I'll never forget, you know, in construction is a license to drink by itself. You know, every Friday night, I'll never forget this, every Friday night we'd get around, and if it was a little cold, like in the winter or fall, we'd burn all the, you'd probably get arrested now for doing it, but we burn all the excess wood and scrap and sit around, and everybody would go buy a case of beer and we'd sit around and drink. And that night we were throwing it into a big pile. Recycling wasn't as big back then, I guess, but here it was in a big pile out in the front yard. And the two owners drive up to check out the progress of their house. And they come back and they go, this looks like the house that Budweiser built. And you know it was true, because it was for that particular night. But after that particular meeting, everyone broke up and drove off. And as I was driving home, there was the plumber pulled over by the CHP in handcuffs. So again, one more time, what this disease does to us. And you know, I had plenty of time and good times in AA, and when I drank. When I drank, it worked for me for a number of years. You know, when I first drank as a child, I remember my mom and dad were gone, and I got this big tumbler down out of the cupboard in the kitchen, and I knew where they hid their booze, so I went and filled up this big tumbler. It was Sigrun 7, I'll never forget. Took a big drink of it, and then just went out and threw up. I mean, and threw the rest of it away. To think how much I wasted there, but that. You know, that's what I saw in my life, and it was a funny thing, as well, is that when because I was the son of an alcoholic, I hated holidays. To this day, it's still hard. I hate holidays. My wife is Pollyanna, you know, so, you know, she starts stringing up stuff now, and I'm getting sick to my stomach, because to me, Thanksgiving and Christmas, with my Irish family there, who was going to get it in the first fight? Was my father going to punch out my uncle and knock him off the front porch like he did last year? Or the year before when they fell and wrestled into the Christmas tree? So those were my holidays, right? And my wife could never figure out why I hated all the holidays. But those were my holidays. And that's the life I lived. And that's what alcohol did to my family. And made me the scared child I was. And I fought that battle through high school. Because I wasn't going to be like that son of a bitch. I was not. But then I was kind of the youngest of my cousins, and then they were all getting married. And so I was a groomsman. So what they had us do at the wedding, we passed out the champagne to everybody. We went around and refilled everyone's champagne. And I hated the taste of that whiskey. And beer, when we drank it, was warm and it wasn't too good either. But that champagne tasted damn good. So what I'd do, I'd pour a glass for somebody and then take a couple of chugs for me. And this shy little boy left that wedding with the best looking girl at that wedding, so I thought. But this was a kid that was afraid of his shadow, and alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's when it was my friend. You know, after that, I'll never forget, you know, I always kept, I'm lucky I didn't get pulled over. I always kept like a half pint in my glove box. And I would always ask the best looking girl out for lunch. And I knew she'd come with me because I had booze. And so I used that for a crutch many a time. When I was in business, when we'd have to negotiate a new contract, I would either bring a six pack of beer or a couple bottles of wine. And it just made the whole thing go smooth. So that was my life. My life became what my childhood was. Because after it stopped working, I had to have that drink. And my poor kids, we would go on a road trip down to San Diego or somewhere, and they go, "Dad, let's stop at McDonald's. I want a Happy Meal." I said, "No. We have to go over here," because I had to have a beer. I took them to a restaurant where there was alcohol because I had to have that beer. So even at that, I'm doing for my kids, not getting the Happy Meal so I could have my beer. But what it really came to a halt was my 40th birthday. And of course, you know, I'm thinking, I'm drinking, leave me alone, I'm not hurting anybody else, you know, I'm the one that's paying for it, right? I'm the one that has a hangover the next day. But my wife started taking pictures of me. And when I saw this picture, when I had this black wreath around my head, and I had eyes the color of that red shirt back there, I realized what a drunk I was. And then when she came to me and said, "I'm tired of being mother and father," as she's throwing a baseball to my son out in the front yard. Because what I do when I came home, I drink myself into a blackout state. So I was never there for them. So she said, "You either become a father to these children, or I'll find someone that can be. It's my way or the highway." And that's when I went in the first time. And, you know, the first meeting I went to, I thought I was going to find all these guys in trench coats, all these guys that you see in the bushes around this town today. But guess what? Guess who I found? I found workmates. A lot of people in construction in there. I found school teachers. A lot of school teachers in here too. I found a doctor and a lawyer and a judge in the rooms of the AA. And that's when I knew that this disease affects everybody. And that's that's when I knew that I could do this program. Why I'm all over the place. You know, if I want to leave anything with you guys, it's what we have to do to stay sober is to get out of ourselves. And something I read today and I was thinking about and praying about today was, what do you do with your actions during a daily life? And what do you do with your prayers? When you're looking at your actions and you're looking at your prayers that you do, are you praying for yourself or are you praying for others? And I can only find peace when I'm working and praying with others and helping people to recover from this disease. And I thought I'd had plenty of time and things to share with you. But as I get up here, I see it's 10 minutes too. Is that enough, Bill? Anybody have any questions? My wife is not here. She thought I graduated a long time ago. Well, that's a whole other story. Okay, guys. I see one in the back. Pardon me? My kids? Please help me. I'm hard of hearing. Okay. That's a good question. Because I think I'm lucky enough where my kids, I think, are normies. But my kids were usually always the ones that busted me. And I remember this one thing where I'm out in the garage, right? And my garage was my bar. Our laundry room was out there, and I would take out that. We had the cleanest clothes in town, by the way. Honey, I'll do the wash. As I go out there, and I was always drinking something where I'd pour my vodka into it. One day I'm out there doing the wash, serving myself at the bar. And my son comes out to me, and here he's a teenager. He's probably 15, 16 years old. And I'll never forget this. He came out to me and he said, "Dad, who do you think you're fooling?" Talk about feeling lower than whale shit. You know, that really hit the spot to me. So my kids were brought into this, and I was never an angry drunk like my father, although I did get belligerent. And I didn't do any wrestling and fighting into the Christmas tree. My wife made sure of that. But I think I was lucky enough to put my 10 years of sobriety when they were teenagers. And I think the way I saved my kids was watching me in those 10 years and the actions that I did in those 10 years. After my wife told me that I need to be a father and not lay there and sleep on the couch, I started throwing that baseball to my son outside. And as I do everything, and as I do it to excess, I ended up coaching him in Little League for 7 years, or Little League and Babe Ruth and everything. So through my actions is how I saved my kids. And God blessed me enough in those first years for them to see me sober. And I really didn't go back out until they were older. Another way I saved my kids is that I made sure they had a spiritual background. You know, I always helped them to go to Sunday school and do the things necessary to get that spiritual background. But I think the main thing is just my actions and showing them that because they remember Papa, they remember the fights, they remember the Christmas brawls, and so I try to show them through living a spiritual life. And another thing God did to me in that for those first 10 years is that's when I lost both of my parents. And the SOB, my dad, that I promised I would never be like and who I hated, got cancer. And when I was sober, I was able to take him to the doctor. I was able to be with him. And I was able to tell him I loved him. And you know, even though I lost him, it was God's way of us making amends to one another. And it was a beautiful thing. Also in that time, I lost my mom. So I lost both my parents in that 10 years of sobriety. I remember after I lost my mom, in the morning I walked right down and took the podium at the Alano Club, crying up there and sharing with my family what I had just gone through. And that kept me sober as well. So, you know, God had quite a life for me as I look back in the rearview mirror here. From the 10 years of sobriety when I needed to save my kids by showing them my actions, when I needed to be the leader in the family, because both my siblings ran away when my parents died. They couldn't face it. And bury both my parents. And to forgive them. Forgive them. Because when I realized in those last few days with my dad that he's just like us. He's just a man that did the best he could. He was a man that was raised by an alcoholic and he didn't know any better. And I remember when I went and saw the movie Shaq, and they show this picture of a child getting beat because the guy that was looking at the picture was beaten by his father. He goes, "Who do you think this?" The guy goes, "Who do you think this is?" He goes, "It's me." He said, "No, it's not you. It's your father." So this is, how do I help my kids? I break the chain. I break the chain. And again, I guess we're at that time. And I want to thank you so much. And maybe before the next 10 years is up, I'll get another chance where I can be a little bit more coherent up here. And may God bless all of you. And may you find the same peace that I have. Thank you very much.